From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
Oh, no, I want to be perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you forget?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday. Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 11th, 2018. Welcome, as always, to our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy. We're taking you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to the nation's capital. So grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I guess we were due for some snow around here.
I mean, well,
yeah.
If you want it, it's
well,
here.
Okay, but it is, it's still early February. I mean,
right. That's right. And a very close friend of mine sent me a text message. She lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And she wanted the snow here. she was jealous of the fact that we had a real winter snowstorm, because she said they haven't had all that much out there, which is interesting because
right.
The D.C. area can really get walloped with
yeah,
snow.
Yeah, it can get hammered with, well, I mean, it's still close enough to the Atlantic
mm-hmm.
that the temperature stays that warm, and you hit the cold front, and they can get it.
Yes, they can.
But even with the storm, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, it wasn't as big as some of the earlier doom and gloom predictions were.
Right,
and
that's right.
And even overnight, okay, 3.5 inches or so, we might get another inch as the day progresses. But it's nothing we can't handle.
Nothing we can't handle. We've all been through much worse. But as we've mentioned and emphasized on the traffic reports, Rick, you know, the slippery roadways are the case out there. Snow reported on a number of roadways throughout the region. And also, the Illinois State Police have now activated their emergency road plan, which means if you're involved in an accident and both cars are drivable, you can move them to the side of the road to exchange information and then file a report later on.
Yeah, and obviously be very careful out there and give the plows some time to do some magic out there.
To do their job, yeah.
Exactly.
As we said, it's tapered off here downtown, but that may not be the case elsewhere.
Right, know. And that's right as of right now.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that we're not still going to get some.
Start up later, yes.
Yeah, although it just in glancing at the radar before I came here in the studio, it looked like it was north part of the city and north, where it said.
Right.
So, but yes, as always, please take care. And just so you know, between newscasts, Dave will be out on Pioneer Court with the newsroom Zamboni.
I got it started this morning.
Get everything all nice and iced up out there over on Pioneer Court for all those people going to the Apple Store.
Well, I thought the Blackhawks were going to have practice.
Oh, you had to go there.
How did I know this was going to turn into... I will not tell
this
you...
This is the entree into the conversation.
Yeah. I won't tell you what Aunt Jo texted me
no,
from
we can't
lovely Asco of Minnesota last night. I just texted her and I said, hey, could you please just let us win one?
Yeah.
Her response was, don't think so. That was only when it was only 2-0. And ultimately, I made it through the first period before I went to bed, and I don't know why. I should have just gone to bed.
That's all you needed to see, really. 2-0, and then they added another one. 3-0, Dubnyk with his fourth shutout. And the Hawks are now 10 points out of that last playoff spot. And I think reality is starting to set in a little bit in that dressing room. Well, they won't really admit it.
Well, they can't. You know, you can't.
But. Well, they're prideful guys, you know.
Right. But just these last couple of games, you just wonder where that drive is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, you sure didn't see any last night.
No, this is a culmination of a lot of things, just to, in my opinion. I think it's a culmination of a lot of hockey games being played by these guys. Not a lot of time off in between those championship runs where you have the real short summer. And, you know, they're not as young as they once were. Right, you know, it's a tough game to play. It's hard to believe that, you know, Toews and Kanemann, they're over 10 years, you know.
It really is. Crazy. It really is. And I mean, people kind of forget that the true talent in these teams that win is the ability to play that entire season.
Mm-hmm.
And that entire season just gets you into the playoffs. But it takes its toll.
I mean,
it's like I joke with people a lot of times. I say, you realize they're on skates, right?
Yeah.
This is
not easy.
You know, that's a lot of strain on the legs. And young legs, that was kind of always the key for the Hawks in those championship seasons.
Well, you know, let me tell you this. I mean, there is a little bit of a thought process going on here, that there is a little transition going on, and that there are some nice young legs to start looking at, even beyond this year with Alex DeBrincat and the way that Nick Schmaltz is playing this year, and Vinny Anastrosa has given them a nice lift since he's been back. I mean, and there's some talent down in Rockford as well. And, you know, Patrick Kane is still playing like Patrick Kane.
Right.
And, you know, he's long in the tooth as well. considering how old he really is. I mean, it seems like he's been here for 40 years.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
So hopefully it'll be a nice little smooth transition. You know, there are some bumps in the road. The Kings went through this after their last championship, I believe, when they beat the Rangers. And it's, you know, you have to kind of, you're a victim of the salary cap, which is tough to deal with in the NHL.
Well, and I have to admit that the other day I almost turned on the Boston Bruins New York Rangers game just so I could get used to watching other teams for the postseason. But I will tell you, I don't know, Andy, if you had a chance, or Dave, to and you should Google this if you can. One of the most unbelievable plays I've ever seen made by a goalie, and this was Tampa Bay's goalie, Andre Vasilevsky, against Kopitar from the Los Angeles Kings. And Kopitar shooting it towards the goal, almost from the goal line. And Vasilevsky reaches behind him and just blindly catches the puck. And stops the puck before it goes in the net.
I'm watching the video right now.
It is unbelievable.
Hang on to that, Andy. I'll come and watch it. I haven't seen it yet.
I know. It's the verbal explanation, it goes nowhere near showing what actually happened. I think actually SportsCenter had it as its number one play of the top 10 this morning.
That's amazing. There's some traffic in front of the net too.
Right. And I don't think Vasilevsky even knew he had it until he, you know, felt it in his glove.
What's the old saying? Better to be lucky than good.
Well, that's why goalposts are goalie's best friend, you know. That's those are the best buddies you could ever have, or the goalposts sometimes. But all kinds of stuff in sports. Yu Darvish coming to the Cubs, $126 million, 6-year contract that puts him, he'd be 37.
Okay.
In the final year.
But here's the thing. From everything that I'm hearing and reading about this, this is a major league front-loaded deal. So a lot of the money is early on in the contract, and there are opt-outs.
That's what I was curious about, like a 2-year opt-out?
Yeah, I think it's 2 or 3. And he's got some incentives in there with extra money being made if there's a Cy Young and things of that nature. So those incentive bonuses are in there. I think the contract, if those bonuses are met, could be worth $150.
Right.
But, again, I think the fans should understand that, yeah, he is 31. He's only 6 months younger than Jake Arrieta. And, you know, he's battled some health issues along the way as well. Had some Tommy John surgery. And last year was the first year he pitched a full season in a couple of years. It was 10-12 overall. But, you know, hey, this is a nice shot in the arm for this rotation, especially if you're going to lose a guy like Arrieta, who I think the Cubs may know something about. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There really hasn't been much conversation, even though he's still out there fielding offers. So,
well, now, is this, you think, open up the free agent drought?
It should. It really should, because I think now teams, you know, it's funny how the Brewers kind of went into retreat there after they made the Yelich move and Lorenzo Cain. They were touting how much closer they were to the Cubs, and now you get another picture of Darvish's caliber if he's right. The Brewers now, I believe, will turn their focus to Arrieta.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. All kinds of news going on out there. Never a dull moment when it comes to Chicago sports. Right. Well, Andy, great to have you on board.
Thank you.
Of course. And Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Casera's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin. Engineer Bob is actually looking for a flamethrower to melt the snow because he doesn't believe in shoveling. You can always find our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Now it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. Another wild week in Washington. In the aftermath of the President's State of the Union address, President Trump noted that Democrats refused to even applaud. The President said that was un-American. And then he went even further.
They would rather see Trump do badly, okay, then our country do well. That's what it means. It's very selfish. And it got to a point where I really didn't even want to look too much during the speech over to that side. Because honestly, it was bad energy. No, it was bad energy. You're up there. You've got half the room going totally crazy, wild. They loved everything. They want to do something great for our country. And you have the other side. Even on positive news, really positive news, like that, they were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? Can we call that treason? Why not?
Now, the White House quickly said that Trump was obviously joking, but with a mercurial presidency, sometimes it's hard to tell what is a joke. That's why Republican Senator Jeff Flake, a frequent Trump critic who is not seeking re-election, well, Flake called out Trump on the Senate floor.
Words matter. Have we arrived at such a place of numb acceptance that we have nothing to say when a president of the United States casually suggests that those who choose not to stand or applaud his speech are guilty of treason? I certainly hope not. One who levels such a charge knows neither the meaning of treason nor the power that the words of a president carry. And if we are numb to such words, then we will surely regret that we failed to defend our colleagues in the Congress against such a vile remark. But our silence will also mark the day that we failed to recognize that this conduct in an American president simply is not normal.
That's Republican Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Fritz Kagi. He's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Cook County Assessor. We'll talk to him about his race against the current assessor, Joe Berrios. After the latest news and sports at 8 o'clock, we'll speak to my good friend and colleague, Monique Garcia. Monique's the State House correspondent for the Tribune. And we'll talk about Governor Bruce Rauner's upcoming budget message on Wednesday, as well as the race for governor in both parties. We'll get a final check of the news at 8:30, and then we'll speak with another good friend of the program, Michael Golden. Michael's the author of Unlock Congress, and he teaches government at Arizona State University, and we'll get his take on ways to restore democracy. That's all up ahead. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Everybody loves a parade. Well, perhaps not everyone. But we know the president does. He's instructed the Pentagon to come up with a Bastille Day-type military parade for Washington. Now, with money tight at the Pentagon, MSNBC's Holly Jackson asked Defense Secretary James Mattis why, if money is important, well, why throw a parade?
You just laid out the argument for fully funding the military, why you think every dollar counts. So why divert time, energy, financial resources to the planning of a parade as the president has asked?
Again, I think that what my responsibility is to make certain I lay out the strategy and make the argument for the oversight of Congress to make a determination of fully funding us. As far as the parade goes, again, the president's respect, his fondness for the military, I think is reflected in him asking for these options.
Now, it's not just Democrats criticizing the parade as a waste of money. Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana also questioned Trump's military parade.
I don't think it's a particularly good idea. Confidence is silent. Insecurities are loud. When you're the most powerful nation in all of human history, you don't have to show it off like Russia does, North Korea, China. And we are the most powerful nation in all of human history. Everyone knows that, and we need to broadcast it. I think we would show our confidence by remaining silent and not voicing it.
Confidence is silent. That's the Republican senator from Louisiana. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Fritz Kagi. He is a Democratic candidate for Cook County Assessor, taking on Cook County Assessor Joe Berrios.
Well, thanks for having me in, Rick. Sure am.
Thank you very much. Tell us about your background.
Sure. I grew up in Chicago on the south side in Hyde Park. And I live in Oak Park today with my wife, Rebecca, and our three kids. My career has been as a financial analyst and portfolio manager, managing people's savings and valuing assets and being a steward over those savings. And I'm a lifelong Democrat, supporting folks who've been running for Congress in the Chicago area. And progressive Democrats have really rallied around our campaign to make the assessor's office ethical, transparent, and fair. And this is something that I've grown up with. You know, I grew up in first became aware of politics in the 80s, growing up in Hyde Park, hearing the names of David Orr and Danny Davis and Chewy Garcia over my parents' table while the council wars were going on. And I can't tell you what an honor it's been to have those progressives behind us to really bring change to the assessor's office.
Why the assessor's office?
This is a really important office. We collect $14 billion of property taxes in Cook County, and the assessor decides how that bill is divvied up amongst all of us who live in the county. And if it's not done fairly, it means that some people are not paying their fair share, and everyone else has to make up the difference. And what we have today is a system where a couple hundred corporate skyscraper owners downtown get massive benefits, billions of dollars of benefits from our assessor, Joe Berrios, because those are the folks who are the clients of the people who donate to his campaign. And the people who have to make up the difference are millions of people in Cook County, especially folks in black and brown communities. And people are sick and tired of it. And that's why we have an earthquake going on now where we're going to have a change to this office.
Everybody's talking about property taxes these days. Now, granted, I mean, and that's statewide, but everybody, it seems almost like this has become the issue in a variety of races up and down the ballot.
Well, it brings together so many different themes. The social injustice of the poor having to pay a higher rate than the rich, that we're giving these huge benefits to folks like Trump and building owners like Blackstone, while we make the highest rates fall on people on the west side and south side where they're being displaced. So that's a social justice end. But then there's all the corruption that this office really has exemplified. With all of the politicians in the state, it seems like, given the choice of a side job, they all seem to favor property tax appeals a lot for some reason. So people don't like that. And then there are all the forces of what's the future of our economy in the Chicago area? What do we stand for? And it's not good for our economy to have this symbol of corruption right there in everyone's face.
There has been talk about banning politicians from having side jobs as property tax appeals lawyers. Are you supportive of those kinds of quote, conflict of interest type.
Well, certainly the voters detest this. And so what the commitment we've made is we're not taking any donations from the property tax appeals industry, and I won't do that as assessor. The legalities of what we do in Springfield, that has to be changed. That requires a new law. I do think it's a good thing that, you know, our congressmen, they're not allowed to have side jobs. Even people who work in congressional offices, they're not allowed to have side jobs because it's considered a conflict of interest. Maybe we should think about that in terms of what we do in the legislature.
But this seems to be kind of a conundrum. I'm not trying to go too far afield, but the conundrum being that the legislature is supposed to be a part-time General Assembly.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be bringing in the diversity of farmers, lawyers, teachers, all of that. And then when you start saying, well, let's make the legislature full-time, that's not necessarily a good public opinion polling item there.
Well, I think what the voters really object to is that there are many folks who seem to be in this field, not because they are competent at the green eye shades business of calculating cap rates and discounted cash flows, but instead they're trading on their public trust and the perception of having the inside track to getting property tax appeals reductions to bring in business for themselves. That's a problem that the people of this county detest. So what we're committed to doing is totally removing even the perception of political influence and favoritism from from how we calculate your assessment and the value of your property. So we're not taking donations from people in that industry, and then we're going to put in additional rules so that we can eliminate even the appearance of people being able to hold out a shingle and say, hey, I can get you a better deal because I'm influential in politics.
Along with those kind of changes, what about is just you have studied the assessment system.
Mm-hmm.
What changes would you bring to bear in the way property is assessed?
Sure. The terrific thing about this race is that the assessor's office is an executive office with the authority to change the way it does business, to change the way it does assessments, to make itself transparent without needing any new laws. We don't have to hope for planets to align in Springfield. So what we're going to do is we're going to implement the new, better model that this office already owns, that they told us that they'd implemented already, that took the Tribune's research last summer to show that people were lying about it when they said that it was adopted. So we're going to adopt that model. It's been shown to be less regressive, more accurate, and the people who developed the model at the University of Chicago and international assessment specialists like Bob Weisbord, they tell us that we can improve upon that model. So we'll try to do that by taking into account foreclosure rates, short sale rates, vacancy rates, and neighborhoods that are impacted by this. Two, we're committed to total transparency in terms of how we calculate your assessment. It is a ridiculous farce that in this state, this county is unique in that it will not tell you even how it arrived at your assessment. People have a right to know, hey, how did you come up with this assessment, which is determining my share of the giant property tax bill that's paid in Cook County? So we want to open that up so this office can become accountable. We're going to show our work, and that will help to eliminate a lot of the bias, the favoritism, the, frankly, error that we find in the system today. It'll concentrate the minds of the folks in the office on, hey, you know, we're not going to be able to hide our mistakes behind closed doors anymore. We're going to have to be consistent, show our work to everyone, make that data and algorithms open and available to third parties for scrutiny. And we're committed to doing that. We don't need a law to do any of this.
We're speaking with Fritz Kagi. He's a Democratic candidate for Cook County Assessor. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in studio is Fritz Kagi. He's a Democratic candidate for Cook County Assessor. Right now, we've got ballot challenge going on with the third candidate in the race, Andrea Rolla. I know that you're supportive of the effort to have her taken off the ballot over issues involving signature legitimacy in her petitions. How important is it for you to have a one-on-one race against Berrios?
Well, we've been focused on Berrios ever since we started our campaign in May. And we meticulously put our team together to go out there to gather the petitions to get on the ballot. The voters are done with Joe Berrios. He has, you know, there was a poll that was just published in the Sun-Times independent poll this weekend showing that we have a big lead. The voters are ready to move on from Joe Berrios. And, you know, we think that everyone should have to follow the rules, follow the law, especially given that our assessor has had so many ethical problems. It's very important that we ethically also follow the rules in terms of how we try to get on the ballot. So that's why we did that challenge.
Can you defeat him in a three-way race?
Yes, we can. Well, actually, there was a poll that was also published this weekend, an independent poll showing that we lead in a three-way poll.
So you're, regardless of the outcome, although it would be easier if it was a one-on-one matchup, is that you would find it easier?
Yes. I mean, we're leading in a three-way poll. We've really emerged as the consensus alternative to beat Joe Berrios. We have our fifth member of Congress who joined us on last week, Representative Mike Quigley, in addition to Robin Kelly, Danny Davis, Bill Foster, Bobby Rush. Those congressmen, they represent the south and west parts of the county, the ones that have been most hurt by the assessment system that we have today. And that's why they're joining us, because they see that I come from outside of the property tax appeals industry, but come also as a certified Illinois assessment officer in the valuation background to really bring change to the office.
So I believe there's a hearing on Tuesday involving this challenge, examiner.
Actually, the hearing officer already wrote his report.
Okay.
I think it's over 70 pages, really extraordinary.
Do you know him at all, the hearing examiner?
I do not.
Okay, I don't know, but...
yeah, never. I've not been involved myself in talking to him, or never wouldn't recognize him.
You talked earlier about the issue of transparency in the assessment process, and I kind of get the feeling for residential, you know, it's a one-size-fits-all kind of model because it's based on comparable home values and that kind of thing, where commercial, I'm not sure people understand the vagaries of how you assess a commercial building, a commercial property. How should that be done?
So on the residential side, it should be a relatively straightforward process. But remember, right now, we are in every neighborhood throughout this county. The more modest your home, the higher the rate you're paying. And that's not what the law says. That is an appalling problem with our system, where you pay a higher rate if you have a $20,000 home than if you have a $200,000 home than if you have a $2 million home. That's unacceptable. So we can fix that. On the commercial side, for any building that has income, especially downtown commercial office buildings, the assessor knows what kind of rent it gets. And then it's just a matter of applying a multiple to that to value it. And this is what investors do around the world with many different kinds of assets. This is what institutional investors do when they value real estate. We can look at what institutional investors are paying for downtown buildings, and if they're comparable in class, we can value these buildings in a very straightforward manner. I find it ludicrous that Joe Berrios would be out there saying, as he has been saying, that, well, Blackstone paid a speculative price when they bought the Willis Tower. So we can't use the price that an informed investor like Blackstone used. I, Joe Berrios, know better, and I'm going to use a lower number. And when he does this, he happens to be favoring the client of one of his campaign donors, and also making everyone else in the county have to pay more as a result of that decision.
In an overarching sense, the fact that the state is so overly reliant on property taxes to fund schools and local governments, is that a fair way to assess taxation for services using what's basically a 18th century style agrarian economy model?
Amen, Rick. We are way too dependent on property taxes. in Cook County and in the state of Illinois for financing government. The main reason why is we do not fund education adequately at the state level, because two-thirds of property taxes are for education. In Illinois, we are dead last in the United States of America in funding education at the state level, number 50, rock bottom. If we were even more towards the median level of what other states do, which have really shown to be successful in doing this, Minnesota, other states in the Midwest, if we did that, property taxes could come down dramatically. It would be a less regressive way of financing education. Parts of the county that are caught in a negative spiral of really excessive property tax levies as compared to property values. Like in the Southland, there are a lot of places where people pay 10% of the value of their home and property taxes every year. In that environment, it's impossible for home prices to rise. So yes, you know, the problem is that the very least credible voice to go down to Springfield to advocate for a more fair school funding formula and for progressive taxation is Joe Berrios. We need to have an assessor who can credibly go down to Springfield to make an argument to other legislators, to the governor, to a new governor, hopefully a Democratic governor, to say, hey, we need to have a new school funding formula and progressive taxation in this state so that property taxes are not carrying such a heavy load.
Fritz Kagi, where can people learn more about your campaign?
You can go to fritzforassessor.com. That's F-R-I-T-Z for F-O-R, assessor.com. You can also go to our Facebook page. There's been a huge amount of news coverage where you can find interviews and coverage about the campaign right on the site.
Fritz Kagi, Democratic candidate for Cook County Assessor, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. It's just out on the Storm Center patio, and regretfully, the snow is back in downtown, although it's very light. So expect it to be one of those kind of days today. It's just going to be kind of drifting in, drifting out. But as Dave told you in the forecast, please just take it easy out there on the roads. Let the folks doing the clearing get the job done. Well, joining me now on the phone is my good friend and colleague, Monique Garcia. She's State House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. And as if we haven't had enough busy weeks in Illinois politics, we've got another busy week ahead with Governor Rauner delivering his budget message on Wednesday. Monique, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So we've kind of heard the governor lay out a concept of what he intends to propose. He says he'll propose a balanced budget. That would be the first time that he would have done so. He says that he will propose a way forward that would reduce the state's personal income tax rate down to 3% over a phase down period. He says that he's going to propose these things, but no one's quite sure how he can do it.
Right. It's an ambitious plan from the governor. Just last week, his new budget chief was testifying before lawmakers and kind of laid out just how bad things are. Hans Zygmunt, the new budget director, said things have stabilized a little bit since lawmakers put in place the tax hike and the budget plan over the governor's veto, but that, you know, the books are still just covered in red ink. Right now, they're estimating that their goal is to try to close a $9 billion shortfall that exists currently. That includes a bill backlog of about $8 billion and another $1 billion or so that the Rauner administration spent trying to keep prisons open and keep public health programs running in the absence of a budget. How you get there is very difficult, especially if he wants to roll back portions of the tax increase. Democratic lawmakers say they look forward to finding out how the governor would be able to do this, given that we don't have an extra $9 billion lying around.
Yeah, and I think that's the big question, because we're still playing catch-up over that two-year budget impasse.
Absolutely. During the impasse, you know, I think everybody was kind of shocked about how the state could operate. And the way that they did that is by running up the credit card. I mean, we had at a high, I think, about almost $20 billion in debt. And we're still paying that down. I mean, the state borrowed billions of dollars to kind of refinance that last year. So we'll be paying that off for years to come. And it's important to note that this debt doesn't just sit there quietly. A lot of it by itself accumulates extra interest rates. So you have the debt racking up, I think the last estimate was about $1 billion in interest rates too. So there's a lot of catch up, and there's a lot of concern about whether or not the governor's going to propose some more cuts, as he tends to do, to try to cover that debt. But he's even acknowledged that cutting is not as easy as it sounds. When the lawmakers passed the budget last year, he said at that point there was about a $2 billion shortfall. That now, they say they've been able to close that to closer to about $600 million through a combination of cuts and borrowing from other funds. So they've acknowledged that they've only been able to cut a few hundred million. There's not a lot of wiggle room there.
And a lot of, as we learned through the impasse, a lot of the funding is done really through court order. So if you do attempt to cut something, it can't be done unilaterally.
Right. Your hands are tied on a lot of this stuff. There are court orders that protect the agency that oversees child welfare. There's some court orders for some groups that provide health care for disabled and developmentally disabled people. So there's not a lot of areas where you can just kind of take the pen and start slashing.
We're speaking with my Tribune colleague, Monique Garcia. She's the State House correspondent for the Tribune down in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, speaking with my Tribune colleague, State House correspondent Monique Garcia. Monique, we've got the budget message coming up on Wednesday. Of course, Governor Rauner, in the midst of a reelection campaign, finding a primary challenger with Jeannie Ives. And obviously, in the past week, the Ives television ad that characterized her view of life under Bruce Rauner, involving transgendered people, women seeking abortion rights, a commercial that sparked outrage, obviously, from those affected groups, but also from elements of the Republican Party itself. But at the same time, here was a candidate, a three-term state representative from Wheaton that most people had never heard of, and now she's running commercials that say, well, now I've got your attention.
Right. And so it's important to note that this budget speech doesn't come in a vacuum. It's very much a precarious political time for the governor, where previously in his speeches, he could almost uniformly count on support from Republicans. But now you do have a challenger in Jeannie Ives, who's really tried to motivate and to try to mobilize conservatives who are upset by some of the actions the governor has done. And you'll note that this week we've kind of seen a shift in the governor's approach to Jeannie. For a long time, he kind of ignored her on the trail, called her a fringe candidate, has even said more recently that he's unelectable. But this week, he went on the attack against her and released a new ad where he's going after her and attempting to tie her to House Speaker Michael Madigan.
It seems like that's a one-size-fits-all strategy from the Rauner camp.
It sure does, and I think it works. He doesn't think it's about his leadership, and that has been a criticism of Jeannie Ives, is that he continues to use Mike Madigan as a scapegoat for failures in his own leadership. She has said, look, I'm able to work with the speaker, which the governor has criticized. And she said, I don't think that we can blame him for everything that's going wrong. When you're in that top office, it's your job to kind of navigate these political minefields and find a way to get your agenda done. And the governor simply hasn't done that, she says.
Well, and it's, you know, I look at it as, you know, she's up trying to appeal to a certain base, and that the ads do represent her base and her beliefs, and the question being how big a base that is. But on the other hand, with Bruce Rauner, there's the open question of what is his base.
Right. I'd note that after his State of the State speech just a week or so ago, we were trying to find folks in the building at the Capitol who would speak highly of him, and it's getting increasingly difficult to do so. There are Republicans who do stand by him, most notably Senate GOP leader Bill Brady. But in terms of voters and what they've really gotten out of this administration, it's difficult for them to quantify that with Governor Rauner.
Well, and I think, you know, we kind of saw elements of this, too, during the budget impasse, where the question being is, at what point is there a disconnect between the Republican members in the General Assembly who have been heavily dependent on Rauner's personal wealth in supporting campaigns and supporting Republicans, but is there a disconnect there to when they actually have to go back to their districts, and what do they have to show for the past 2 years?
Absolutely. And a lot of lawmakers have said, you know, we don't need the money anymore. The money is nice, but it's not keeping me from getting beat up when I go home, and universities are cutting, social service agencies are shutting down, and we've not been able to put in place things we've promised them, like lowering property taxes or putting in term limits or doing things to help businesses. We've not been able to accomplish that. So at what point do we have to start making votes for what's in the best interest of our district versus what's in the best interest of Bruce Rauner and the Republican Party?
So we are in this election season. We have the governor giving his budget message, and we have the governor raising the issue of whether Madigan just wants a stalemate on a budget so that the state goes back into a budgetless kind of cycle for political purposes. Now, that's something that the Democrats deny. But nevertheless, you have to wonder if that there isn't some calculation there that another budget impasse is inevitable.
Sure. I don't think you'll find anybody who says they want another one, but I don't necessarily think that means that this process is going to be easy moving forward. Crafting a budget is difficult in any year, not to mention a year we're coming out of the impasse and where Republicans joined Democrats to put the budget in place over the governor's veto and heading into an election. So I think we're still going to have some drama and some fireworks here. It's not going to be smooth sailing by any means on either side. So it's really kind of a wait-and-see game right now that's got a lot of people's stomachs in knots, quite frankly.
Well, and then, you know, each legislator has their own kind of special constituencies. And, you know, you look at the budget that was recommended for higher education by the State Board of Higher Education, which didn't really go as far as necessarily public institutions wanted it to go. They wanted it, I think, to go back to kind of the pre-impasse funding level. But I can still see individual rank-and-file legislators from university communities kind of pushing for even greater higher education spending than what was recommended.
Absolutely. And they'll point to damage that was done during the impasse and say, now is the time that we need to be investing. We've seen attendance dropping at universities. We've seen more students enrolling out of state, and they will say that this is the time that we need to be putting money into those institutions to stop that, to stop tuition hikes, to stop people from going out of state. And you'll see that argument, too, in K-12 education. They just put in place a new funding formula that aims to put more money into the system, specifically to help lower-income school districts, including CPS. And they'll say, we need more money for that. There's always a need for money. There's a question of where that money comes from.
And what may have to be on the chopping block to try to get there to those kinds of goals. And budget speeches presenting a budget is presenting a reflection of priorities.
Right. And the governor year after year has targeted some similar groups. He targets some of these social service groups that provide drug treatment or provide help for the homeless. And these are areas that aren't protected by those court orders. So they're, I wouldn't say easy for them to cut, but that he's able to cut unilaterally on his own. And so you're going to see a lot of pushback from those groups who are going to try to preserve what little money that they've been able to get in the last couple of years.
A lot to look forward to on Tuesday evening and Wednesday when the governor delivers his budget address. Monique Garcia, State House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, as always, thank you so much. We've got a lot of work ahead of us.
We sure do.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Nice and warm here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. But I know somebody who's probably a little bit warmer. That's my friend Michael Golden. He's the author of Unlock Congress, and he's a senior fellow at the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy. And he also teaches at Arizona State University. So how are things in Arizona this morning?
You know something, I don't miss the snow, but I do miss the Sunday Spin. That's the best I can come up with.
That's the best you could do. So what's the temperature right now?
It's about, I'd say, 60 degrees at 7:38 Mountain Time, and it'll be 75 in an hour or two, not to sound obnoxious to all my old Chicago friends.
I just did that on purpose, because I wanted everybody to just hate you right now, okay?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, me and my dad's in town, and we're both trying to figure out the Blackhawks. I promised him I'd ask you. I got my jersey on this morning. I promised him I'd ask the expert what's going on there. What's going on with our guys?
Well, we talked about this earlier. They're just they're aging. They're getting aged, and it's a long season, and I don't think the legs are holding up, and it's going to be a transition time for the Blackhawks. And
well, after all those championships, they deserve a little rebuilding, right? That's the best way to look at it.
That's right, and I'm still rooting for them.
Absolutely.
But it's 10 points out of the playoffs, last playoff spot. That's a rough road to hoe. So, Michael, I know you were at this Unrig the System summit in New Orleans. And what was that, and what's the goal? What did you take away from that?
Well, I just heard, you talking the rest of the show, and particularly the last round, about Illinois politics. It's really funny. My friend, and someone you know too, Dan Prof, when he ran for governor in Illinois several years ago, his catchphrase was, Illinois politics isn't broken, it's fixed. And 6 years, which is, he ran a brilliant low-dollar campaign at the time, and 6 years later, I'm at a national conference in New Orleans talking about how democracy needs to be reformed desperately. And who do I hear but former CEO and Harvard professor up on the stage talking a lot about the principles I wrote about in Unlock Congress, and then saying the American democracy is not broken, it's fixed. And so there were reformers from all over the country, Rick, all over the country who were doing things on a local level. A lot of them are connected to this group, represent.us. Josh Silver, a friend who's been on my program before, he basically organized this entire national conference with big voices and ways people can make a difference. And their whole philosophy is doing this on a state-by-state level, in local communities, on ballot initiatives, pushing lawmakers in the states to change these things, whether it's rigged districts through terrible gerrymandering, whether it's campaign finance and ethics laws and conflict of interest laws, which applies to the judicial branches in our government, but not in so many cases, in most cases, to the way that our legislators, the people we elect, make laws. They talk about solutions too, whether it's open primaries, vote by mail, automatic voting registration, ranked choice voting. My friends at FairVote, Rob Ritchie, who taught me all about that 4 years ago when I wrote the book. It's not just about rigging the districts or drawing the lines. We're a regionally polarized country. We've self-sorted ourselves, as you know, and those congressional districts, they're not really reflective of the diversity of the country, and I mean political diversity, too. We don't get independent candidates winning. There's sore loser laws in 40 states where if you're an independent in the primary, if you lose, you can't run in the general election. And there are elections where independents are more popular than anybody from the two major parties, from the legacy parties. So that's what Unrig the System Summit was about. You mentioned the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy. We have a coalition we're building in Washington, an agenda for political reform, and there are a lot of voices from our group there, from Take Back the Republic to Fair Vote to Common Cause. The upshot, Rick, is that there's a revolution going on in this country, quietly in different states and not so quietly in others, that's going to turn this system of elections on its head so regular folks are better represented, because right now, going back to Dan's expression, the system is fixed.
Well, you touched on the issue of conflict of interest, and I actually brought this up with Fritz Kagi, a candidate for Cook County Assessor, about in the legislature and conflict of issues. But I was curious about, you know, here in Illinois, our legislature is supposed to be a part-time legislature and supposed to represent the diversity of interests that exist through in that method. And the conundrum of that being, well, the opposite of that is, okay, let's have a full-time legislature, and I'm not sure that that polls all that well.
Yeah, you know, there's a similar argument when people debate term limits, and I even open it up in classes at Arizona State to students. Are you for or against? You know, what are the reasons? And, you know, that the founders debated term limits and ultimately decided against it so that people in office would have a motivation to perform and be reelected. Now, the other side of that is that you have career politicians that are there 30, 40 years, and maybe they're not serving the people, they're serving their own interests before they go through that revolving door to lobbying. And then the flip-flop of that, again, is that, well, you need experience. You need people, back to your example, maybe you need people full-time and maybe even to be there several years before they really get their hands around the legislative process, the nuts and bolts of it, and how it works. In fact, term limits is one of the things that I'm not totally against it. I don't forcefully push for it in Unlock Congress. I think that these other things first to fix the system, to repair the system, if you will, being the money and ethics and fair voting, fair representation, and ranked choice voting, open primaries. There are things that we can do that will make these people, and these people are us. The people we elect are just us that put their names on a ballot. We need to make them more accountable and to make sure that more people are represented.
We're speaking with Michael Golden. He is the author of Unlock Congress, and he is enjoying the warmth of Arizona right now. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Now I'm speaking with Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress. Michael, the issue of independent maps and the issue of gerrymandering and that kind of thing, now that we've seen kind of the courts taking this up, is that kind of forcing the hand on this a little bit?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I didn't want to get too deep in the weeds on that, but right now there's not just one, there's two cases before the Supreme Court. Map in Wisconsin, and then just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court, in a surprise move, decided to hear a case from Maryland. And it's interesting because for the first time, it's very possible that they will rule that political gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, but political gerrymandering, where you're outright favoring one party or the other in a drawing of a map, thus rigging the district and not giving people their real rights of being represented, is unconstitutional. And the interesting thing about taking the Maryland case, the second one, is that now they have two cases there, one filed by Democrats, one by Republicans. And some people who observe the court very closely think that it's possible they took that second case to make it look, when they rule, like they're being more nonpartisan. If they strike down both maps, then they're saying a pox on both parties' houses. You can't do this. And it's sort of, it could be seen as sort of a hint that they wanted to rule on this and tell the map makers to knock it off and try to draw them far more fairly. And so we're going to hear about that any day now, and it's certainly the next couple months. And Rick, bringing it back to, you know, what's been going on nationally, we still don't have an infrastructure bill. We still don't have a health care fix. There are, you know, I have family members in that donut hole. There are real things going on in the country, even if it's a budget at the last minute, where the tribal warfare is off the charts. It doesn't get any better. It may look better for a second last week because the two Senate leaders agreed at the last second on a continuing resolution, but that's not how the government's supposed to function. And they don't pass appropriations bills the way they used to for different causes. They just package it all together in this big omnibus mess. And part of the reason is because the parties aren't able to negotiate with each other in good faith and get these things done in a timely fashion. So I don't mean, you know, I get in the weeds a little bit about the reforms and all this stuff, but it matters in people's lives because American government is not American government anymore, not the way it used to be.
Well, and, you know, when you look at the polarization that goes on, for example, in the drawing of Illinois' legislative districts in the Constitution, it was designed to be a bipartisan process in that if the two sides couldn't agree, that then you flip a coin and you decide basically or draw a name out of the hat, giving one party the priority over the other party to draw the map lines. But that whole threat of chance was supposed to be a threat to try to get both sides to work together in drawing the map lines. And instead, the parties basically decided that they're better off with the going to chance, because then it's winner take all.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, there was a great example. Just last week, I did a trivia question in class for a $10 coffee to the winner. How about that?
Wow. I'm coming to your class.
It's not bad, right?
Right.
I told them, we had talked about gerrymandering in the Supreme Court and this stuff, and then lo and behold, a few days later, the Supreme Court actually came out, and so in Pennsylvania, a map had been struck down as unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court. Basically, the vote was roughly, I don't know, 54-56% for the Republicans versus the Democrats, the overall vote in the congressional elections in the state. And the Republicans own about 12 seats to 5 versus the Democrats. It's a fully rigged map. And the state Supreme Court said, you got to redraw the map. That is unconstitutional. And the Republicans, or whoever was representing the Republicans, they filed this with the Supreme Court to get a stay, to have it halted, to say, no, you don't have to redraw the map this quick. We're having your election, your primary coming up. And the Supreme Court refused. They said, no, go redraw the map. Figure it out. They said it's on. So there are a lot of hints that some of this stuff is being overturned. And don't forget, there's an uprising, a quiet but steady uprising in the country about Citizens United and all of the money. And even though Represent.us, I was telling you, Josh Silver, and all these groups around the country are working on local anti-corruption measures, and they're having great success. And there's an interactive map, by the way, before I forget it, represent.us. I would take a look at it. Anyone who's interested, you can see in your state, in your town, you can see what's going on. They're creating this map as we speak. But you know, with what's going on with gerrymandering and the potential moving back on that in the Supreme Court and the historic ruling, who's to say that won't, the same thing can't happen on the money, on the big super PACs and all of that big money influence in the next year or two? So everything's on the table right now because people are fed up and there's a bottleneck happening and in New Orleans it was kind of exploding.
So one other thing I wanted to ask you, this, and I know the show isn't long enough, that ranked choice voting is a very interesting concept. Just could you explain how that works?
Yeah, that's even with 15 minutes a little tricky to explain to a full classroom of Sun Devils. But actually, the basics of it is easy to understand. Right now, we have single-member districts. And in every congressional district, you only have one member. There are other ways to do this, and we've done it in other ways in our country, and we do in local elections. You can create a super district of three or four members, and then you have, no matter how many people are on the ballot, you do it by ranked choice voting. So instead of just voting for one person, you'll vote, if there's three members in a super district, you'll vote one, two, three. You'll choose your first three choices out of seven or eight. And by a mathematical formula that I don't have the time to explain, everybody's vote is represented. Because even if you don't get your first or second choice, there's still points involved. There's still mathematical meaningfulness involved in your third choice. So you don't have to worry about wasting your vote or about spoiler candidates. This is a way where you rank. And also, by extension, these candidates in the campaigns, they have to try to reach out to more people. They can't just hammer one opponent over the head with millions of dollars in negative ads because it's not a binary choice. And like I said, my friend Rob Ritchie taught me about this several years ago when I was researching for the book. And they have these things going on in Oakland and Minneapolis and Cambridge. They had it passed in Maine. There was a court challenge, but in the state of Maine. So, you know, it's tricky to do because Congress has to repeal a law from 1967 when it comes to the congressional seats because they mandated one person per district. So to get multi-seat districts is a little tricky because one party kind of owns the congressional map right now, but that could swing the other way. So again, on a local level, these things are happening, and the people who run in these races and even won these races have said, this is a better way to elect people. I'm even a better person governing because of the process. I had to listen to everybody. I had to fight for everybody's vote. And so, you know, it's an up-and-coming thing, ranked choice voting. And people in New Orleans were just sort of, you know, their attitude, a thousand of them from all over the country was, hey, this is simple stuff. We just got to get the word out to everybody, and we can repair this thing.
Or in Illinois, be everything old is new again, since that was the way that the Illinois House was elected back in the day before the...
Cumulative voting. That's a great point, cumulative voting. And they did a study with, I believe, Abner Mikva and... Jim Edgar is the co-chairs, and they studied how government was before that changed, and they said, they concluded that Illinois' House worked a lot better as a democratically elected government when it was cumulative voting, which is similar to ranked choice. It's a great example.
Michael Golden, my good friend, author of Unlock Congress, who is teaching government and democracy at Arizona State University, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. I'll be back in May. See you at the Billy Goat. I'm going to be in Chicago for quite some time. I miss everybody back there, and thanks for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.